From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Clive Owen. He's starring in the new adventure film, King Arthur, and the new independent film noir, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, which is directed by Mike Hodges, who also directed Owen in Croupier. And we meet Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, the founders of the band One Ring Zero. For their new CD, As Smart As We Are, they've set to music lyrics by such novelists as Dave Eggers, Paul Auster, Daniel Handler, Rick Moody, and Margaret Atwood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush said today that despite the fact that no weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq, the U.S. did the right thing to go to war there. Mr. Bush had used the suspected WMD threat as his major justification for invading Iraq.
Every potential adversary now knows that terrorism and proliferation carry serious consequences, and that the wise course is to abandon those pursuits.
The president spoke after visiting the Oak Ridge Nuclear Laboratories in Tennessee. There he viewed nuclear weapons hardware from Libya, now under U.S. guard. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry dismissed Mr. Bush's claim that the U.S. is safer. He said the U.S. has not taken every step it should to stop North Korea's and Iran's nuclear programs. The interim Iraqi government said today it is close to offering amnesty to insurgents who lay down their arms, but the Iraqi president warned opposition fighters that if they keep up attacks, they could be killed. Morgan Stanley has agreed to pay $54 million to settle a federal sex discrimination suit. The settlement was announced just as a trial was about to get underway in federal court. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The firm will pay $40 million to settle sex discrimination complaints by some of its female employees. Another $12 million will be set aside for the lead plaintiff in the case, a former bond trader named Allison Shifflin. Former federal judge Abner Mikva was appointed to monitor the firm's progress in addressing discrimination. U.S. officials had claimed that Morgan Stanley routinely denied promotion opportunities to women and tolerated a workplace where sexist behavior occurred. For instance, U.S. officials said male employees took clients to topless bars and striptease clubs. The firm said that kind of behavior had happened in the past, but was no longer permitted, and it denied discriminating against women. The settlement was announced just as opening arguments in the trial were about to begin. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
Also today, investment banking firm Piper Jaffray said it will pay out a settlement on improper stock trading practices. Two report cards were issued today at the International AIDS Conference in Bangkok. NPR's Richard Knox say they show efforts to get drug treatments to poor people with AIDS are falling short.
Certainly, there are critics at this meeting in Bangkok that are really angry about the slowness of raising this money and getting the money out to treating people. There are only about 7% of the people who need AIDS drugs in the developing world are actually getting them. And so there's a long, long way to go to treat the 6 million people or so who really need them.
That's NPR's Richard Knox reporting from Bangkok. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 25 points, closing at 10,238. Trading was moderate. Advancers beat decliners by 9-7. The Nasdaq was down 9 at 1937. This is NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Shimon Peres, the leader of the opposition Labor Party, agreed today to form a unity government. The alliance could boost chances for success of Sharon's plan to withdraw Israeli settlements and troops from the Gaza Strip next year. Sharon also warned hardliners in his own right-wing Likud party that he'd call early elections if they stand in his way. Sharon and Peres are the last two members of Israel's founding generation remaining active in politics. Ron Reagan, the son of the late Republican President Ronald Reagan, will address the Democratic National Convention later this month on stem cell research. The younger Reagan and his mother Nancy have promoted stem cell research as a possible contributor to cures for numerous diseases. The federal government's cholesterol education program is recommending more intensive treatment for people at high or moderately high risk of having a heart attack over the coming decade. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
The new guidelines call for more use of statins, the powerful and popular cholesterol-lowering drugs. The guidelines also emphasize that proper nutrition, physical activity, and weight control can lower heart attack risk. Among the recommendations, very high-risk people who already have coronary heart disease plus other risk factors should consider taking enough statin drugs to get their LDL levels down to 70 or below. LDL is the so-called bad cholesterol. Moderately high-risk people who have two or more risk factors and a 10 to 20% chance of having a heart attack in the next 10 years should consider getting their LDLs under 100. Details of the recommendations appear in the July 13th issue of the journal Circulation. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MGM Pictures, presenting Kevin Kline and Ashley Judd in DeLovely, the story of music legend Cole Porter, now playing in select cities.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Clive Owen is starring in two movies on opposite ends of the commercial spectrum, the spectacle King Arthur and the independent film noir I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. The British actor made his American breakthrough starring in the independent film Croupier. Owen played a novelist leading a double life as a blackjack dealer in a casino. Owen has reunited with the director of Croupier, Mike Hodges, to make I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. Their new film has echoes of Hodges's now classic 1969 revenge film Get Carter, which starred Michael Caine. But although I'll Sleep When I'm Dead is also about revenge, it's not about a violent rampage like Get Carter. Clive Owen plays a gangster who has left the violent life. In order to keep away from that life and his own violent impulses, he's become a hermit, living in his van outside of the city. But when his brother Davey, a small-time drug dealer, is murdered, Owen wants revenge. Here he is, slipping back into the city, talking to his former lover, played by Charlotte Rampling.
Look at me. Look at what I've become. I sometimes don't talk to another living soul for f***ing days. Weeks. I'm always on the move. I trust no one, nothing. And it's got f*** all to do with escape. Or withdraw fear. It's grief. For a life wasted. And now there's Davey. Another f***ing wasted life. And I'm gonna find out why.
I asked Clive Owen if he and director Mike Hodges talked about the nature of the violence in the film.
The only really clear, strong discussion I can remember is whether at any point we see Will Graham actually show that violence, of whether the lid comes off and we see what he's capable of. I remember there was a scene in Croupier, and I remember feeling very strongly there's a fight scene in Croupier where somebody goes to fight him and the character gets into a fight, and because it was a similar character in terms of keeping the lid on. I was very clear and that I wanted to let the lid off just that once, show what was underneath this guy and then put it back on again so everybody could see what he was capable of. So we had discussions about whether we should do a similar thing with Will Graham, about whether we should suddenly see the violence that is within him and the violence that people are talking about having seen in him. But we decided in the end that it would be sort of tighter and tauter and more tense if we didn't actually release it throughout the whole movie.
You're kind of emotionally dead in the movie, and so you're not registering a whole big wide range of emotion, fear, anger, joy, laughter. Laughter isn't in the picture for you.
It's not.
So how does that affect what you can use as an
actor? Strange, because it was quite a deceptive script, because it was very lean and it read as being pretty straightforward, but when I actually came to start playing the part, you realise that you can't just do nothing, you can't breeze those situations. Just because the character isn't saying very much, you still have to be very full up of emotion. He's a very emotional character, it's just that there's a lid on it all the time, and there isn't much dialogue to use. So really it was a case of sort of filling up and then putting the lid on, and that was deceptively hard. I remember when I first started, I remember thinking it's much harder the work than I thought it was going to be.
There's a lot that we don't know about the characters in the film. There's a lot we don't really know about your character, including exactly what happened that required him to, like, leave the city and separate from his past so that he could disassociate from his violent past. Did you feel that you needed to know more than the audience knows about your past so that you could really inhabit the character?
I always find that I need to know what I'm talking about. If there's a direct relation to what I'm saying, what other people are saying, then I need to have the information there. But I often don't need more than that. I'm not the sort of actor who feels the need to go off and research whole worlds. You hear of actors, you know, they play a doctor, they'll go and live as a doctor, they'll talk to doctors, they'll immerse themselves in that world. I tend to be more instinctive than that. I think ultimately, the bottom line is you watch a movie and you believe the person. The person says the lines, you believe them or not. And my thing in this movie was really, as long as I knew anything that anybody talked about my character or that I said, I was fine with that. I didn't need to ultimately, all you're doing is, you know, you're capturing the scenes, and that's, I felt I did what was necessary and no more, really.
My guest is Clive Owen, and he's starring in the new movie I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, which is directed by Mike Hodges, who also directed Owen in the movie Croupier. I want to ask you about Croupier. This is such a terrific film, and in this you play a writer who takes a job as a croupier running a blackjack table in a casino. And let me just play a short scene from the film. The film has a lot of voiceover narration from your character, and he's usually talking about himself, both as himself, Jack, and as Jake, the main character in his novel. Let me play some voiceover narration from your character toward the end of the film. He's at the blackjack table.
Chapter 10. He watched their faces as they lost, hour after hour, night after night, relentlessly. He questioned the conventional wisdom that gamblers are self-destructive. He had come to believe that in reality they want to destroy everyone else. Their families, loved ones, everyone. Over the whole world. Without emotion, he watched them go. Jake stayed.
That's Clive Owen as the croupier in the film The Croupier. This is a really such a great film in part about the meaning of risk. Like, what kind of risk is worth taking? When are you being a sucker? What are some of the things you did to get into the spirit of this film? You're not a gambler. Your character is not a gambler. He's opposed
to
gambling.
He's very against gambling, yeah.
Yeah, but he takes a lot of big gambles that just aren't in the casino. But anyways, so he takes this job at the casino as a croupier at the blackjack table. What's some of the preparation you had to do for this, even in terms of just like learning how to deal?
I actually went to croupier school for a couple of weeks and actually trained with the guys that were teaching there, literally just slotted in and did it properly for 2 weeks, which was a real insider's look at the way casinos work, really, because I was taught as they were taught. We were taken around the casino. We were forbidden to gamble because all croupiers are. And I remember the thing that struck me more than anything was it's one of the few environments where there's still a lot of cash casinos, which is unusual in this day and age, to have so much cash flying around. So ultimately, they are obsessed about not being ripped off. So when they're teaching croupiers, they drill into them every single day, do not think you'll ever be able to take a penny from this casino. We've got everything covered. You'll never get away with it. And I remember thinking that sort of slight paranoia was really striking. And it is related to the fact that, you know, you're handling money all the time. It's not credit. It's, you know, and there are stories of people having developed scams, croupiers developing scams. They don't tell you this. You hear it from other places of scams of how to actually, you know, get money and take it from the casino. And then I remember the other really important thing we discovered very early on in the movie is often with voiceover, you'll play the scene and Michael shoot the whole movie and then the voiceover is laid on afterwards. You put the voiceover on. And there was on the first or second day, I was at a blackjack table and I was just generally doing some dealing. And Mike said, yeah, we'll lay some voiceover over that. And it concerned me a bit. And I went round to see him in his hotel room later. I said, I'm a bit concerned about this because it feels very unspecific to lay the voiceover just over general dealing. And I said, I think it needs to be more specific than that, because often the voiceover is in the present tense. It just didn't feel tight. So we came up with this plan where I would go off and learn all the voiceovers. And then when we actually came to shoot them, I would speak them out loud. And then we would do a take where I just thought them. So there'd be people there, there'd be extras there. And the thoughts were very, very specific. So if I thought about a particular character or a person that was at my table, I could flick them a look. I could... And it worked very well. It didn't mean to say that Mike had to use all of that, because obviously he can cut away, he wants to do whatever he wants to do. But the times where he did use it, it made the voiceover very... You felt like you were inside the guy's head. It made it very, very present. And I remember that was a key discovery that we made together early on in the movie.
My guest is actor Clive Owen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Clive Owen. He's starring in two new films, the epic King Arthur and the independent film noir I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. He starred in the film Croupier, and he made a series of action shorts created as ads for BMW and shown on the internet. Each starred Owen at the wheel of a BMW driving a high-risk passenger. The shorts were directed by such luminaries as John Woo and John Frankenheimer. I asked Owen how he got the part.
It was really through Croupier. Croupier had just sort of made its impact in America, and then I got this call saying, did I want to do a series of commercials for BMW? And I said, no, I didn't, because I was meeting... things seemed to be opening up a bit. I was meeting lots of interesting people, and I thought it wouldn't be a very smart, cool thing to do to just jump into a bunch of commercials, because I didn't really know that much about them. And they came back and asked again, and I said, no, I really don't want to do commercials. I don't want to do this. And then right at the wire, they sent me the script of the first one, which was this 10-minute, proper, fully-formed little movie script, very well written. They said, we've secured John Frankenheimer and Ang Lee to do the first two. And I suddenly thought, this project is really unusual. It's very different, and it's... You know, they're attracting serious quality people. So I literally jumped on a plane the next morning, arrived in LA, and was taken straight from the airport to a night shoot with John Frankenheimer to shoot the first one. And I'm just enormously grateful that it didn't pass me by, because, as you say, I ended up working with some of the world's top directors, and it was a very exciting project. To work with that caliber of director was really exciting.
So what are some of the differences between how, say, John Frankenheimer and John Woo directed you behind the steering wheel?
Yeah, I remember that the very first one, that Frankenheimer is regarded as the king of the car chases, and he took... His really is one long car chase, and he showed me examples of actors driving fast in movies and examples of people that did it well and people who didn't do well and why they did. And he... had the whole thing down to absolutely every cut of the chase. So he knew when he was going from steering wheel to rear view mirror to road to, and was incredibly specific and knew down to literally like 3-second shot. Like, this is a bit, you're just going to just pull the wheel this way. Just literally 2-3 seconds and he'd be out of it. But he was that specific, and you realize that's why he's so great at doing car chases, because... You know, he puts that much attention and tension to it.
I'll remind our listeners that John Frankenheimer, among other things, directed French Connection 2. So when he was showing you examples of good and bad acting behind the steering wheel, what were some of the things he pointed out?
It was really just to do with whether they looked like they were really driving fast. They looked in the situation. And some people didn't. When you watched them, you thought, they're not connected with the speed of the car, with... everything else, and other people looked very much in the situation. I really just looked at it, and it was you know, the same acting principles apply. There was nothing particular about it. It was just, you've got to really make people feel and believe that you're in this dangerous, you know, high-speed car chase. I think he was the one that invented the whole notion of, which I did a lot of, because a lot of people said, did you do a lot of the driving yourself? But what they used to do is they used to rip the steering out, put it on the other side, place a stuntman driving the car, give me a dummy wheel, and as long as you frame out the guy sitting next to me, they can throw that car around and drive it pretty fast with me actually in it, so you can see the world racing by outside the window. And I did quite a lot of that, and I think it was John that was the first guy to do that.
What did John Woo, what kind of advice did he give you?
I mean, he was, I can't remember anything, you know, specific John Woo said, but I was a big fan of John Woo, and he's, you know, brilliant at putting together action, and there's a sequence in his one that was pretty, you know, one of the more stunning car sequences of the whole series, really. But
Is that the one where the car's spinning around a lot?
Yeah, and there's a bridge being slowly going up, and there's a car, you know, there's a whole sequence where the car eventually just spins to a stop, and the wheel literally is on the edge of this very high bridge. It's a pretty stunning car stunt.
And were you in the car for that stunt?
No. They took the stunt guy got as close as he could do, then they would replace the car with the wheel on the edge and then put me in it.
We've established that your face registers a lot in films. In the BMW films, basically, it's mostly you behind the driver's wheel, and your face has to express a lot. In Croupier, your face has to express a lot, certainly in I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. What was it like the first time you saw your face on screen?
It's very strange. I wouldn't say that was the strangest thing, because you're used to seeing photographs of yourself. The strangest thing is seeing the whole of you, really. The first time you see yourself on TV or on film, walking down a street or turning around, it's the perspectives that we don't get that is the most unusual. You think, oh my gosh, I walk like that, I look like that from that angle. That's the sort of oddest thing, to see yourself that objectively. It's a very unusual experience.
Were there things you tried to fix or change about yourself after seeing your full body from every perspective?
It's strange, though, because I'm sort of wary. There are always people going to be advising you that certain aspects of yourself, the way you talk, the way you carry yourself, can be better. You know, your posture could be better, your voice could be better, it could be clearer. And I'm always a bit wary, because I think ultimately acting is about, you know, you can't be too contrived. You can't be worrying about things like that ultimately. You've got to... It is an emotional job that demands a commitment. Of course, there's always an element of skill, and you know, you learn and improve and get better. It is a craft, but I'm wary of too much of it. So I am, in a similar way, I'm wary of changing things that other people think it'd be better. You know, I'm 6'2", but I don't often stand up very tall. But I'm comfortable in the way I carry myself, and I, you know, suddenly if I start, you know, standing up much straighter, and it just feels different. It feels less like me, and I feel I'm becoming something else, and I'm wary of that.
When you first started on the BBC in England, and you did your first series, which was called...
There was a series I did called Second Sight, but that wasn't really where I started. I'd done a lot of work before then. The first sort of big TV series was a series called Chancer, which was a series on ITV in the UK way back when. It was like, you know, 13 years ago.
Now, I read that after that series, or maybe during that series, as you were becoming really popular, the tabloids started to move in on you. What was it like to, you know, suddenly, when you were still like pretty young, have this kind of scrutiny?
I found it very unsettling. I found it, you know, I went into this TV series, you don't really know what to expect. You're a very young guy, and suddenly when the series explodes and becomes this big primetime TV success, the tabloids get very interested. The tabloids love television. They love, you know, actors in television. And I was pretty naive, and they'd throw all the tabloid newspapers at me into my trailer to talk to, and I thought, you know, you'd probably have to talk to everybody, and I'd talk, and then you'd get these sort of really tacky stories. I mean, nothing too vicious, but just, it was all just unsettling and felt sort of ugly, and I found it very difficult. I was really sort of quite resentful of it. I was very young, and I didn't quite know how to deal with it. So when it came to this, I did the second series of this show, an older actor said to me, you know, you can say no. So I did, and I said, I'm not talking to the press. And then I got this obvious reputation for being difficult with the press because I just, you know, avoided them and didn't talk to them all during the second series. And then I did one big press conference at the end of it to get some press out of the way, and people said, why have you not talked to us for a year or whatever? And I said, and I explained my reasons, that I find it difficult, you know. Then every tabloid was full of Clive Owen, the price of fame, Clive Owen shuns fame, the difficulty of being a TV star, and it was horrendous again. It was like, I couldn't win.
I know one of the things one of the tabloids did was track down your birth father, who had left the family, I think, when you were three. Let me just stop here and ask you if this is something I can ask about or whether you just...
It depends what you ask.
Okay, okay. Well, if it's a problem, you just tell me.
Okay.
Had you already met him before the tabloid tracked him down?
I had it was very difficult for me because my father had left the home and I did this TV series, and actually the character I was playing was somebody who was estranged from their father, and I was just very wary and cautious that the tabloids would love this as a story, you know, the parallels of my character and the fact that I myself, you know, was estranged from my father. So I was very wary, and that's probably another reason why I found it so difficult with the tabloid newspapers, because there was something I was hiding, there was something I was protecting, and they smell that, I think. I think they start talking about personal things and you look uncomfortable, and they're very experienced in honing in on the areas that people obviously hiding something or are wary of, and that was it for me. And eventually it all came out in the tabloids about my father, and it wasn't that big a deal, and eventually it was quite freeing up for me, because then there was nothing I had to protect. I didn't, you know, I wasn't feeling that I had to be as careful around that area, and in a way it coming out in the tabloids was probably a good thing. It sort of opened it up.
Were you trying to protect yourself or your father?
I didn't want that parallel of somebody's, you know, my personal... Nobody wants their personal life in that way put out in the tabloids. And to a certain extent, you know, as I've got older and married and got children, there are certain areas of my life that I don't think are for public consumption. And I think, you know, I'll talk about the work, I'll you know, to talk about my career but the very personal private stuff that matters is I just don't understand the impulse to share that with newspapers or journalists in any way.
Well, Clive Owen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Clive Owen is starring in King Arthur and I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's kind of like an accordion, but you blow through a mouthpiece. Coming up, Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, two of the very few musicians in the world who own claviolas. Their band, One Ring Zero, has a new CD featuring lyrics by such novelists as Dave Eggers, Rick Moody, and Daniel Handler. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. They play lots of instruments, including one you've never heard of. They write cool music, and the songs on their new CD feature lyrics by such novelists as Rick Moody, Margaret Atwood, Daniel Handler, and Dave Eggers. My guests, Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, are the founders of the band One Ring Zero. They met while working for Hohner Harmonica, repairing and tuning instruments. Their new CD is called As Smart As We Are. This track, Natty Man Blues, features lyrics by novelist Paul Auster. Band One Ring Zero, Michael Hurst, Joshua Camp, welcome to Fresh Air. What instruments are we hearing on that song?
It's so many instruments, we can't even remember what we put down. Claviola is one of the main instruments, theremin, and
there's some guitar.
Slide guitar.
Organ. There's specifically the Thomas organ from the 70s.
And, of course, voice. That is an instrument, after all.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the claviola, and if our listeners are thinking, claviola, I've never heard of that, there's a good reason they've never heard of that, and what is that reason?
The claviola was a short-lived it had a short life, shelf life, I guess. It was introduced in the mid-90s, maybe 94, 90, 90, 95, 96, and quickly was discontinued because no one bought it because it was too expensive and
over-engineered.
Over-engineered.
We like to refer to it as the Edsel of the music industry.
Yes, exactly. Which is what drew us immediately to it, and we started a band based around it.
Really, is that how you started the band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the most ridiculous thing we'd ever seen, and decided to form a band right there and then.
Yep.
And you were both working at the Hohner Harmonica factory at the time.
It's actually a warehouse for North America, and Michael was the assistant harmonica technician, and I was the assistant accordion technician.
Believe it or not, I spent 8 hours a day tuning harmonicas 5 days a week.
Wow. Well, I want to hear a little bit more about that a little later, but first I want to hear more about the claviola. I think you've brought one with you.
I did.
Yeah.
One of the 14 that came to North America.
Just amazing. Would you describe it, just visually, before we hear it?
I like to refer to it as, it looks like a swan that's been run over by a car. It you wear it similar to an accordion, except you have a mouthpiece that you blow into, and it has this one wing that comes off to the left side, which encases several pipes that shape the sound further from just the free reed sound.
So there's an accordion keyboard type thing on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, it looks like there's pipes almost like a really large pitch pipe.
Exactly,
yeah.
Except the opposite.
A pan pipe is probably closer.
Right.
Visual.
Okay. Can you play it?
I can. And it's actually on the opposite of what you said. The right side is the... Not that it matters. Sorry.
Oh, the right side is the keyboard. That's the opposite
the right
of
side
the accordion,
is the keyboard.
Isn't
yes.
it?
Otherwise, I'd be horrible.
No, accordion is also right. The right side.
Oh, okay.
You can get some nice note bends. You can actually put your left hand over the pipe and change the pitch slightly.
See, you're getting that bended note by moving your hand on the panpipe side?
Exactly, yeah. sort of creating an extension of the pipe itself to make the pitch go down.
Huh. Right.
But then, you know, we've come up with some interesting techniques. I guess there's hasn't been any.
Yeah.
There's no method book for us to follow on how to play it. So we've.
That was the nice part about it. We just sort of created our own way to play it.
Well, do you know
you can also inhale on it.
Oh, do that.
The inhale is a different sound.
We don't use that much, but. It's a little thinner.
It's like a harmonica you can inhale.
Yeah, it's more
on
like
that.
A harmonica.
Yeah, that's so fun. Uh-huh. And then, of course, flutter tongue. Well, not of course, but. You know.
Wait, how are you doing that?
I'm actually rolling my tongue. It's a technique that a lot of.
Yeah, wind players use it.
Wind
all
players
the time.
Use and just kind of doing a brrr sound with my tongue and.
I think that's really great that this kind of bizarre instrument that most people thought was totally useless, that you actually get these really wonderful sounds out of it that you could use either for novelty effect, but also just for, it could be really pretty.
Yeah.
It really it makes some beautiful sounds.
Haunting. Yeah.
So I just think it's really interesting that probably, I mean, has anybody outside of you guys ever really used this instrument?
Well, you know, having worked at Hohner, I can almost name everybody who bought one of those 14.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, there are several people. I know John Medeski actually bought one from me, and so he's used it with Medeski, Martin, and Wood, and you know, there's several other people. Rob Schwimmer, who's been on tour with Paul Simon recently playing claviola. So, you know, there's a few around, and we need to go find them and steal them.
We need to eliminate the competition.
My guests are Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, the founders of the band One Ring Zero. Their new CD is called As Smart As We Are. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the founders of the band One Ring Zero, Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp. Their new CD, As Smart As We Are, features lyrics by such novelists as Paul Auster, Daniel Handler, Rick Moody, and Dave Eggers. Did you ever talk to the inventor of the claviola?
No, that's an interesting story. The inventor was Dr. Ernst Zacharias, who was sort of the most famous inventor that worked for Hohner over the years, and his most successful invention was the clavinet, which was made famous by, you know, a lot of early 70s keyboard players, specifically Stevie Wonder, you know, very superstitious, that whole era. And I think he actually came up with the claviola idea in the 60s, about the same, you know, maybe a few years after the clavinet. And it was never, Hohner never decided to put it into production or you know, come up with any kind of practical design for it until the 90s, maybe.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about the whole story, well, there's a couple things. One is that these guys still wear lab coats in the factory in Germany, which is just great. I love it.
Yeah, it's like really.
We are engineers. But the other thing that's fascinating is that Ernst Zacharias never intended for these things to be played in pop settings. I think it was very.
Yeah, the clavinet was to him amplified clavichord, really.
He was expecting it to be appropriate Germanic music, you know, Bach and whatever. But, you know, then Stevie Wonder took it and ran with it. And so I don't know how thrilled he would be at what we're doing with the claviola, but.
What did he intend it for?
Well, that's a good question. I have no idea. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that as far as free reed instruments go, I mean, it's in the same family of accordion and harmonica, obviously. The direction of air is in the opposite of all these other instruments. The reed vibrates essentially the wrong way, which is why it sounds so different than accordion or harmonica.
Well, why don't we hear one of the tracks on your new CD, As Smart As We Are, that prominently features the claviola. Now, the song we're gonna play is called Radio, and it's a song with a lyric by Daniel Handler, who writes the Lemony Snicket novels. And, you know, all the songs on this new CD are lyrics by writers that you have set to music. So, anyways, before we actually hear it, if you could just play the claviola line from the beginning of the song so we could hear what the claviola is doing. Great. And here it is in full 3D on the recording from the new CD, As Smart As We Are.
If I had a radio for every time you loved me so, I wouldn't have a radio at all. Now I sit and waste my time, my room is quiet as a mime, and wait for someone glamorous to call.
It's a lyric by Daniel Handler, who writes the Lemony Snicket novels. It was set to music by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, the two members of the band One Ring Zero. And all of the songs on their new CD feature lyrics by writers that One Ring Zero set to music. And the CD is called As Smart As We Are. Well, I think your songs are just really, really good. And the instrumentation is so interesting. Before we talk about setting these writer songs to music, let's go back to the Hohner Warehouse, was it, that you worked?
And
yes. That you worked in. You were both technicians. One of you was working with accordions and one with harmonicas. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what your day was like as a harmonica and a technician and an accordion technician? What did you do, fix the instruments?
Joshua spent, you spent your entire days repairing, tuning, and
I actually towards the end there, I was mostly running the department because my boss was in charge of research and design, and so I would answer phone calls and keep track of all the accordion parts to sell to various accordion technicians around the country. Yeah, it was. A lot of our jobs was trying to make the lower end quality accordion harmonicas sound a little better for the American market. That was most of our day.
Right.
Well, your new CD features lyrics by writers that you set to music. How did you start doing this?
We just kind of stumbled into a literary scene. We both moved up to New York. Originally from Richmond, Virginia, and in 2001 we both moved up to New York, and I had read a heartbreaking work of staggering genius by Dave Eggers, and a friend of mine said, I think Dave Eggers has this little curio shop down the street in Park Slope in Brooklyn, and I walked up and down 7th Avenue in Park Slope looking for this store, and I stumbled upon it and finally found it and handed a CD to the store manager, who loved it and quickly invited us to play readings that they were having in this little space. I mean, the room was no more than 5 feet by 8 feet. And we would have Rick Moody and Viggo Mortensen, these guys who Viggo was actually reading and not there to act. But, so we were all cramped in this room, and Joshua and I would get up on stage and play a few songs before the readings began. And that's kind of how we met all these authors.
No, these authors are not lyricists. Did you ask them to write lyrics that you could set to music?
We did. It was interesting. Rick Moody was kind of the first person to take a liking to, the first person to really pull us in that direction. He saw us performing at one of the readings and invited us to improvise behind him while he read the opening chapter from his novel Purple America. And we got on stage and just winged it. And it turned out so well, we actually ended up eventually recording it and did several songs or improvisations behind Rick Moody's spoken word. And at that point, we thought it'd be fun to turn the tables and ask Rick if he would be willing to write us some lyrics. And there are originally three songs that he wrote lyrics for, two of which are on our previous album, Memorandum, and the third, which we saved for this CD. And that was kind of the impetus to start asking other writers to, and you know, have this idea of maybe just get all these authors that we've met to write lyrics for us.
Well, one of the lyrics you were given was just a haiku.
That's
an urban haiku, or suburban haiku. So I thought, that's just a few seconds. I thought we'd hear that one, and then we'll hear another song. But let's start with the haiku. Who's the writer of this?
That's Aaron Napersteck. I had read a Talk of the Town article in The New Yorker about this guy who lived in Brooklyn who got frustrated with all the traffic in front of his apartment and actually threw some eggs out of his window at the car and caused this whole ruckus in the neighborhood. And he turned that into writing haikus against the whole automotive industry, I guess, and started posting these on telephone poles throughout his neighborhood, and it caught on. Other people in the neighborhood started doing this and adding them, and all these haikus were popping up on telephone poles, and I was so fascinated. We had just started this project. I was like, we should contact this guy and get him to give us a haiku or write a haiku for us, and you know, he was thrilled to do it, so that's how Honku, as he calls them, came to be.
Right. That's how we wrote a 28-second song.
Okay, well, here it is from the album As Smart As We Are by One Ring Zero. Okay, well, there it is, the anti-automotive haiku set to music by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp of One Ring Zero. And all the songs on their new CD, which is called As Smart As We Are, feature lyrics written by writers that One Ring Zero has set to music. Let's go to a slightly longer song that you set to music. And this is one by the writer Dennis Johnson. And the song is called Blessing. Tell us about Dennis Johnson and about setting his lyric to music.
Dennis Johnson was one of the more difficult authors for us to get a hold of. I guess originally when I kind of pitched the idea to him, he wasn't so sure that our music and his words would go together. And, you know, after several emails, he finally said, well, you know, I guess if I was going to do this, I would kind of want a country song. So we're like, well, we'll write a country song.
Yeah.
So that's how that came to be. And I mean, they're fabulous lyrics. They're really great.
Beautiful.
And
we're from Virginia, so, you know, we can handle country.
That's right. And when we finally sent the finished product to Dennis Johnson, I got a phone call from him, and he was just so excited and said he was so honored to be on this, and it really made us both extremely happy that we'd pulled it off.
And relieved.
So this is a lyric by the novelist and poet Dennis Johnson, set to music by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp of One Ring Zero. They're singing on it as well and playing all the instruments. This is from their new CD, As Smart As We Are.
And the condemned man in his tuxedo dream, his dream of limousines and innocence. Off your clothes and come to him in dreams. Stand on the fire escape, naked and blessed, with jazz like a rivulet of codeine, the laughter spilling from our broken necklaces.
My guests are Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, the founders of the band One Ring Zero. Their new CD is called As Smart As We Are. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guests are the founders of the band One Ring Zero, Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp. Their new CD, As Smart As We Are, features lyrics by such novelists as Paul Auster, Daniel Handler, Rick Moody, and Dave Eggers. Can you read a few of the lines that you thought were really good that some of these writers and poets gave you, but that are not typical song lyrics?
Well, we don't even need to read them because we sing them and we have them memorized. But
sure.
Which is good since we don't have them with us. But Christ by the dumpster, peeling and tossing your lottery tickets, O Nazarene.
Drinking dust.
Drinking dust. that was more lyrical. Jonathan Ames' lyrics are fascinating. That's straight prose. And
that's Dennis Johnson who you just...
That was Dennis Johnson that I was right. just saying. Jonathan Ames clearly gave us straight prose, and that was a challenge to make a song with. He has the story that I've heard him tell several times at public readings about the sound he made when he was a kid called the Harry Call, and it somehow relieved him of all kinds of childhood ailments. He had a corset on his back and a
elevated testicle.
An elevated testicle, right? So, and somehow he made this sound with his buddies on the playground, and it became this story. But so the lyrics he gave us were, "When I was a little boy, I was very troubled. I had a bad back and an elevated testicle. I was 8 years old. I wasn't exactly off to a great start in life. For my back, I had to wear a corset. For my testicle, there is nothing to do but wait." You make a song of that.
Yeah.
What was the process for this? Was it different from sitting down to melodicize a more conventional lyric?
It was a matter of sitting down with a guitar and just singing the words until some kind of pattern formed, essentially.
We ended up having to go back to Jonathan and ask him if he could come up with just one sentence that we could at least somehow repeat and make into a chorus. And that's when he came up with, "I'm a trumpet in a wall. This is the story of the Harry Call."
Yeah. So at least we had some kind of...
Something to repeat to make
some song structure element.
Well, why don't we hear the Harry Call? And this is One Ring Zero from their new CD, Smart As We Are.
Back, I had to wear a corset for my testicle. There was nothing to do but wait. I'm a trumpet and a wall. This is the story of the Harry Call. One day in fourth grade, Jonathan Fat Eater made a sound, a little prayer sound from the bottom of.
Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, the two members of the band One Ring Zero, and their new CD, As Smart As We Are, features lyrics by novelists and poets that Hurst and Camp set to music. And they also sing on it and play all the instruments. So when you guys got together and you realized you wanted to form a band together, what were you playing at the very beginning?
I think our first project was a klezmer project. This is before the Claviola.
That's right.
We were just using melodica, and the band was called the Klezbians. I just said that, didn't I?
You did. We had a Klezbian in the band. It was okay. It was legit.
I guess that made it okay.
Sure. But that was a lot of fun. We actually would get... I had a house in Richmond that I still own, actually, and the reason I bought the house for the most part was to set up a recording studio in the basement. And we would have these rehearsals once a week that never led to anything. We never had the intention of playing live. It was just once a week we'd invite whoever was interested to come over and join us in the basement to play klezmer standards, which there actually are klezmer standards. And there's whole books of klezmer standards. And we would just get together and
but we ended up recording a record of klezmerized Christmas songs.
Minor key.
Yes. Called A Very Klezmian Christmas.
Why were you so interested in klezmer?
I think it kind of going back to all the various folk musics that we're exposed to. And I somehow got a, when early on in school, and when I was in college, somebody gave me a book of klezmer standards. I didn't even know it was called klezmer music. I just referred to it as crazy Jewish music. And then someone, when I played it somewhere, said, "Oh, that's klezmer music."
That was, crazy Jewish yeah. music.
Sorry. I've never told Michael this story. And I loved it. I still play those songs that I learned. And I definitely started writing in that style as soon as I got that book.
Finally, I'm wondering, since there are only about 14 claviolas in the world, what happens if yours breaks?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
We go find John Modesky.
Steal the one you sold him.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Do you have access? Do you know who's got the other remaining ones?
Not all of them. I mean, we know where a good chunk of them are. I mean, the one good thing of this whole situation is Josh and I were both repair technicians at Hohner, so we know how to fix them.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
That is helpful.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah. We're thrilled to be here.
Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp are the founders of the band One Ring Zero. Their new CD is called As Smart As We Are. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, children's book author and NPR commentator Daniel Pinkwater talks about his books and his own childhood. His new book is called Looking for Bobowitz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.